process. It is the consciousness of duality and the subjectively realized and synchronously acknowledged sense of I am God and I am form which has plunged mankind into the great illusion. Yet it is this very illusion which renders up to man eventually the secret password into the kingdom of God and brings about his release. It is this Maya itself which serves to guide him into truth and knowledge. It is on the plane of the astral that the heresy of separateness has to be overcome, and it is on the field of Kurukshetra that the individual aspiring Arjuna and the cosmic Arjuna learn the lesson that the knower and the known are one. The secret science of the Master of the Wisdom is the secret of how to dissipate the fogs and mist and darkness and gloom which are produced by the union of the fires in the early stages. The secret of the Master is the discovery that there is no astral plane. He finds that the astral plane is a figment of the imagination and has been created through the uncontrolled use of the creative imagination and the misuse of the magical powers. The work of the hierarchy is primarily to bring to an end the shadows and to dispel the moisture. The aim of the Masters is to let in the light of the soul and to show that spirit and matter are the two realities which constitute the unity, and that it is only in time and in space, and through the cyclic misuse of the magical and psychic powers, that the astral plane of the great illusion has come into being, and is now so real a thing that it is, in a certain sense, more real to man than the kingdom of light and the kingdom of form. In one most interesting sense, it is true that because the human being is a soul, and because the light of the soul is found within him and is gradually growing into fuller radiance, this itself produces the illusion. Because of this illusion, the magical work has been carried forward along wrong lines and has been based on wrong motives and fitted into a scheme which is stronger than the average worker, for the whole force of the world illusion is against all the efforts of the beginner in white magic. The rules, therefore, end with the statement that the magician chants the words that blend the fire and water. But these are the rules for the aspirant. The rules for initiates of a paralleling kind end with the words, let the initiate sound the note that unifies the fires. This is significant and of much encouragement to the beginner in the magical work. He is still perforce working on the astral plane, and he cannot possibly avoid so doing for much time. The mark of growth for him is the steady withdrawal of his consciousness from that plane and his attainment of mental poise and of mental awareness, followed by creative work on the mental plane. There is an interesting and ancient proclamation found in the archives of the adepts, which covers some of the stages in the magical work, couched, of course, in symbolic form. Quote, let the magician stand within the great world sea. Let him immerse himself in water, and there let him stand his ground. Let him look down into the watery depths. Nothing is seen in form correct. Nothing appears but water. Beneath his feet it moves, around him and above his head. He cannot speak, he cannot see. Truth disappears in water. Let the magician stand within the stream. Around him water flows. His feet stand firm on land and rock. But all the forms he sees are lost in the gray immensity of mist. The water is around his neck, but, feet on rock and head in air, he maketh progress. All is distortion still. He knows he stands, but where to go and how to go he knows not, nor understands. He sounds the words of magic, but muffled, dim, and lost, the mist returns them to him, and no true note sounds forth. Around him are the many sounds of many forms, which swallow up his sound. Let the magician stand in watery mist, free of the running stream. Some outlines dim appear. He sees a little distance on the path. Flickers of light break through the clouds of mist and fog. He hears his voice. Its note is clearer and more true. The forms of other pilgrims can be seen. Behind him is the sea. Beneath his feet is seen the stream. Around him, mist and fog. Above his head, no sky is seen nor sun. Let the magician stand on higher ground, but in the rain. The drops pour down upon him, the thunder breaks, the lightning flashes in the sky, but as the rain pours down, it dissipates the mist, it washes clean the form, and clears the atmosphere. Thus forms are seen and sounds are heard, though dim as yet, for loud the thunder roars, and heavy is the sound of falling rain. But now the sky is seen, the sun breaks forth, and in between the drifting clouds, expanses of the blue of heaven cheer the tired eyes of the disciple. Let the magician stand upon the mountain top. Beneath him in the valleys and the plains, water and streams and clouds are seen. Above him is the blue of heaven, the radiance of the rising sun, the pureness of the mountain air. Each sound is clear. The silence speaks with sound. Close quote. Then come the highly significant phrases which give the picture of the consummation. Quote, let the magician stand within the sun, looking from thence upon the ball of earth. From that high point of peace serene, let him sound forth the words that will create the forms, build worlds and universes, and give his life to that which he has made. Let him project the forms created on the mountain top in such a way that they can cleave the clouds which circle around the ball of earth and carry light and power. These shall dispel the veil of forms which hide the true abode of earth from the eye of the beholder. Close quote. Such is the end of the magical work. It involves the discovery that the astral plane and the astral light, so-called, are but the cinematographs created by man himself. What man has created, he can also destroy. More as to the magical work I may not at this time give. The words that blend may not under any circumstances be given except under the oath of secrecy which governs automatically the pledged disciple. These oaths are given to no man, but are rendered by the aspirant to his own soul when that soul has conveyed to him the words. He finds them for himself as the result of tireless effort and endeavor. He knows that these formulas are the prerogative of all souls and can only be known and safely used by those who have realized the self as one. He therefore pledges himself never to reveal these words to anyone who is not functioning as a soul or who is wandering blinded in the veil of illusion. From this automatic response to knowledge by the knowers of the race, the hierarchy of adepts has gathered its personnel. A call to service. In closing this treatise on the magical work of the individual aspirant, I seek to do two things. First, indicate the immediate goal for students in this century and summarize the steps that they must take. Second, indicate the things which must be eliminated and overcome, and the penalties which overtake the probationer and the disciple when mistakes are made and faults are condoned. First of all, the immediate goal must be well recognized if lost effort is to be avoided and real progress achieved. Many well-intentioned aspirants are prone to give undue time to their registered aspirations and to the formulation of their plans for service. The world aspiration is now so strong, and humanity is now so potently orienting itself towards the path, that sensitive people everywhere are being swept into a vortex of spiritual desire, and ardently long for the life of liberation, of spiritual undertakings, and of recorded soul consciousness. Their recognition of their own latent possibilities is now so strong that they overestimate themselves. They give much time to picturing themselves as the ideal mystic, or in deploring their lack of spiritual achievement or their failure to achieve a sphere of service. Thus they become lost, on the one hand, in the vague and misty realms of a beautiful idealism, of colorful hypotheses, and of delightful theories. On the other hand, they become engulfed in a dramatization of themselves as centers of power in a field of fruitful service. They draw up mentally plans for world endeavor to see themselves as the pivotal point around which that service will move. They frequently make an effort to work out these plans and produce an organization, for instance, on the physical plane, which is potentially valuable, but equally potentially useless, even if not dangerous. They fail to realize that the motivating impulse is primarily due to what the Hindu teachers call a sense of I-ness, and that their work is founded on a subjective egoism which must and will be eliminated before true service can be rendered. This tendency to aspiration and to service is right and good and should be seen as forming part of the coming universe of consciousness and equipment of the race as a whole. It is steadily coming to the surface owing to the growing strength of the Aquarian influence which, from about the year A.D. 1640, has been gaining in potency and is producing two effects. It is breaking down the crystallized old forms of the Piscean Age and is stimulating the creative faculties as they express themselves in group concepts and group plans. As all of you well know, this is the cause of the present disturbed conditions, and these conditions can be summed up in the words impersonalization, wherein the state, group, or groups are regarded as of more importance than the individual and his rights. Amalgamation, which is the tendency to fuse, blend, and cohere, and to produce that interrelation which must eventually mark the intercourse of humanity and produce that synthesis of all the single men, which Browning so truly remarks, is the goal of the evolutionary process and marks the conclusion of the journey of the divine prodigal. And sensitive intercommunication between units, groups, and combinations of groups, both on the subjective and objective sides of manifestation. In these three words, impersonalization, amalgamation, and intercommunication, you have summed up for you the outstanding phenomena which are appearing among us at this time. Students are urged to consider the plan as it is thus expressing itself, and to study these growing tendencies in human affairs. The fact that they are so prominent will appear if the student will take the trouble to consider the panorama of history. He will then note that even the history of 500 years ago will reveal to him the fact that at that time great individuals were the prominent factors, and that history is concerned largely with the doings of powerful personalities who cast their spell over their time and age. Then isolation and separateness governed human affairs, and every man fought for his own land, and every man forgot his brother and lived selfishly. Then there was little interrelation between different races or between human families, and there was no real means of communication except that of personal contact, which was frequently impossible. Students should therefore ponder on these words, which will be found to become of increasing importance during the next 50 years. This is far enough ahead for the average student to look and to plan, and in their recognition of this phase of the working out of the divine purpose, they would do well to study their individual life expression and to ask themselves the following questions. 1. Are they wasting time in mystical dreams, or are they occupied in a practical application of the sensed spiritual truths, thus making them part of their daily experience? 2. Do they find that their reaction to the growing impersonality of the age is one of resentment, or do they find that this relatively new attitude of personal detachment is tending to solve their own personal problems? 3. Can they register an increasing ability to sense the thoughts and ideas of others, and do they find that they are becoming more sensitive and therefore more able to swing into the great tide of intercommunication? 4. How much is the faculty of dramatization governing their daily life? Do they find that they are the center of the universe, which revolves automatically around them, or are they working at the problem of decentralizing themselves and at absorption in the whole? These and other questions which will arise may serve to indicate the responsiveness of the aspirant to the coming in of the new age. In this treatise on individual development and on astral control, a vision has been given and a rule of life expounded which holds in it the needed instruction for the interlude between the two great ages, the Piscean and the Aquarian. A part of the underlying purpose has been expressed in words, a purpose which is recognized by many all over the world and which is working out in practically every department of human life. It is subconsciously registered and intuitively followed by many who know nothing of the technicalities of the plan. Those who guide the human race are not particularly concerned as to the success of the emerging new conditions. That is most definitely assured, and the growth of human realization and of the spiritual consciousness of non-separateness cannot be arrested. The problem is, what means to continue to employ to bring these desired ends about in such a way that the form nature can be keyed up and prepared to handle its new responsibilities and deal with its new knowledges without undue suffering and those painful cleavages and hours of agony which attract more attention than the more subtle and successful growth of divine awareness. Every time there is a tendency towards synthesis and understanding in the world, every time the lesser is merged in the greater and the unit is blended in the whole, every time great and universal concepts make their impact upon the minds of the masses, there is a subsequent disaster and cataclysm and breaking down of the form aspect and of that which might prevent those concepts becoming physical plane facts. This is therefore the problem of the hierarchical workers. How to avert the dreaded suffering and carry man along whilst the tidal wave of the spiritual realization sweeps over the world and does its needed work. Hence the present call to service, which is sounding like a trumpet in the ear of all attentive disciples. This call to service usually meets with a response, but that response is colored by the personality of the aspirant and tinctured with his pride and his ambition. Need is truly realized. The desire to meet the need is genuine and sincere. The longing to serve and lift is real. Steps are taken which are intended by the aspirant to enable him to fit in with the plan. But the trouble with which we on the inner side have perforce to deal is that though there is no question as to willingness and desire to serve, the characters and temperaments are such that well nigh insuperable difficulties are presented. Through these aspirants we have to work, and the material they present gives us much trouble frequently. These latent characteristics often do not make their appearance until after the service has been undertaken. That they are there, the watching guides may suspect, but even they have not the right to withhold opportunity. When there is this delayed appearance, the tragedy is that many others suffer besides the aspirant concerned. As the human fabric makes itself felt and stands out of the mist of idealism, of lovely plans and much talk and arranging, many are in the meantime attracted by synchronous idealism and gather around the server. When the hidden weaknesses appear, they suffer as well as he. The method of the great ones, which is to seek out those who have trained themselves somewhat in sensitive response and to work through them, carries with it certain dangers. The ordinary well-meaning aspirant is not in such danger as the more advanced and active disciple. He is in danger in three directions and can be swept off his feet in three ways. 1. His whole nature is under undue stimulation on account of his inner contacts and the spiritual forces with which he is in touch, and this carries with it real danger, for he hardly knows as yet how to handle himself and is scarcely aware of the risk entailed. 2. The people with whom he is working, in their turn, make his problem. Their greed, their adulation and praise, and their criticism tend to becloud his way. Because he is not sufficiently detached and spiritually advanced, he walks bemused in a cloud of thought forms and knows it not. Thus he loses his way and wanders from his original intent, and again he knows it not. 3. His latent weaknesses must emerge under the pressure of the work, and inevitably he will show signs of cracking at times, if I may use such a word. The personality faults become strengthened as he seeks to carry his particular form of service to the world. I refer to that service which is self-sought and formulated on a background of personal ambition and love of power, even if only partially recognized or not recognized at all. He is under strain naturally, and, like a man carrying a heavy load up a steep hill, he discovers points of strain and evinces a tendency to break down physically or to lower his ideal so as to conform to weaknesses. To all this must be added the strain of the period itself and the general condition of unhappy humanity. This subconsciously has its effects on all disciples and upon all who are now working in the world. Some are showing signs of physical pressure, though the inner life remains poised and normal, sane and rightly oriented. Others are breaking up emotionally, and this produces two effects according to the point of development of the aspirant to service. He is either, through the strain, learning detachment, and this, curiously enough, is what might be called the defense mechanism of the soul in this present period of world unfoldment, or he is becoming increasingly nervous and is on the way to become a neurotic. Others, again, are feeling the pressure in the mental body. They become bewildered in some cases, and no clear truth appears. They then work on without inspiration, and because they know it to be right, and they also have the rhythm of work. Others are grasping opportunity as they see it, and to do so fall back on innate self-assertion, which is the outstanding fault of the mental types, and build up a structure around their service and construct a form which in reality embodies what they desire, what they think to be right, but which is separative and the child of their minds and not the child of their souls. Some, in their turn, more potent and more coordinated, feel the pressure of the entire personality. The versatile psychic nature responds both to need and to the theory of the plan. They realize they're truly valuable assets and know they have somewhat to contribute. They are still, however, so full of what is called personality that their service is gradually and steadily stepped down to the level of that personality, and is consequently colored by their personality reactions, their likes and dislikes, and their individual life tendencies and habits. These eventually assert themselves, and there is then a worker, doing good work, but spoiling it all by his unrealized separateness and individual methods. This means that such a worker gathers to himself only those whom he can subordinate and govern. His group is not colored by the impulses of the new age, but by the separative instincts of the worker at the center. The danger here is so subtle that much care must be taken by a disciple in self-analysis. It is so easy to be glamored by the beauty of one's own ideals and vision, and by the supposed rectitude of one's own position, and yet all the time be influenced subjectively by love of personal power, individual ambition, jealousy of other workers, and the many traps which catch the feet of the unwary disciple. But if true impersonality is cultivated, if the power to stand steady is developed, if every situation is handled in a spirit of love, and if there is a refusal to take hasty action and to permit separation to creep in, then there will be the growth of a group of true servers and the gathering out of those who can materialize the plan and bring to birth the new age and its attendant wonders. To do this, there must be courage of the rarest kind. Fear holds the world in thrall, and no one is exempt from its influence. For the aspirant and for the disciple, there are two kinds of fear which require to be especially considered. The fears that we dealt with in the earlier part of the treatise and the fears that are inherent, as you know, in existence itself are familiar to all of us. They have their root in the instinctual nature, economic fears, fears arising out of the sex life, physical fear and terror, fear of the unknown with that dominating fear of death which colors so many lives, and have been the subject of much psychological investigation. With them I do not seek to deal. They are to be overcome by the life of the soul as it permeates and transforms the daily life, and by the refusal of the aspirant to accord them any recognition. The first method builds towards future strength of character and prevents the coming in of any new fears. They cannot exist when the soul is consciously controlling life and its situations. The second negatives the old thought forms and brings about eventually their destruction through lack of nourishment. A dual process is therefore carried forward, producing a genuine manifestation of the qualities of the spiritual man and a growing freedom from the thraldom of age-old fear concepts. The student finds himself becoming steadily detached from the prime governing instincts which have hitherto served to weld him into the general scheme of the elementary planetary life. It may be valuable here to point out that all the major instincts have their roots in that peculiar quality of the planetary life, fear reactions leading to activity of some kind. As you know, the psychologists list 5 main and dominant instincts, and we will very briefly touch upon them. The instinct of self-preservation has its root in an innate fear of death. Through the presence of this fear, the race has fought its way to its present point of longevity and endurance. The sciences which concern themselves with the preservation of life, the medical knowledge of the day, and the achievements of civilized comfort have all grown out of this basic fear. All has tended to the persistence of the individual and to his preserved condition of being. Humanity persists as a race and as a kingdom in nature as a result of this fear tendency, this instinctual reaction of the human unit to self-perpetuation. The instinct of sex has its main root in the fear of separateness and of isolation, and in a revolt against separative unity on the physical plane, against aloneness. And it has resulted in the carrying forward of the race and the persistence and propagation of the forms through which the race can come into manifestation. The herd instinct can easily be seen to have its root in a similar reaction. For the sense of safety and for convinced assured security, based on numerical aggregations, men have always sought their own kind and herded themselves together for defense and for economic stability. Out of this instinctual reaction of the race as a whole, our modern civilization is the result. Its vast centers, its huge cities, and its mass tenements have emerged, and we have modern herding carried to the nth degree. The fourth great instinct, that of self-assertion, is also based on fear. It connotes the fear of the individual that he will fail of recognition and thus lose much that would otherwise be his. As time has progressed, the selfishness of the race has thus grown. Its sense of acquisitiveness has developed, and the power to grasp has emerged, the will to power in some form or another, until today we have the intense individualism and the positive sense of importance which have produced much of the modern economic and national troubles. We have fostered self-determination, self-assertion, and self-interest until we are presented with a well-nigh insuperable problem. But out of it all, much good has come and will come, for no individual is of value until he realizes that value for himself, and then, with definiteness, sacrifices the acquired values for the good of the whole. The instinct to inquire, in its turn, is based on fear of the unknown, but out of this fear has emerged, as a result of age-long inquiry, our present educational and cultural systems and the entire structure of scientific investigation. These tendencies based on fear have, because man is divine, acted as a tremendous stimulation of his entire nature and have carried him forward to his present point of wide comprehension and usefulness. They have produced our modern civilization with all its defects and yet with all its indicated divinity. Out of these instincts carried forward into infinity and out of the process of their transmutation into their higher correspondences, the full flower of soul expression will emerge. I would like to point out the following. The instinct of self-preservation finds its consummation in assured immortality, and of this the work undertaken by the spiritualists and psychic investigators right down the ages is the mode of approach and the inevitable guarantee. The sex instinct has worked out and finds its logical consummation in the relationship, consciously realized, of the soul and the body. This is the keynote of mysticism and religion, which is today as ever the expression of the law of attraction, not as it expresses itself through physical plane marriage, but as it finds its consummation, for man, in the sublime marriage carried forward with conscious intent between the positive soul and the negative and receptive form. The herd instinct finds its divine consummation in an awakened group consciousness, which is evidenced today in the general tendency towards amalgamations and the widespread fusing and blending which are going on everywhere. It demonstrates in the ability to think in terms of internationalism, of universal concepts, which will eventually result in the establishing of universal brotherhood. The instinct of self-assertion, in its turn, has given to our modern civilization its intense individualism, the cult of the personality, and the production of ancestor and hero worship. It is leading, however, to the assertion of the self, of the divine inner ruler, and out of our newest science, psychology, will emerge a knowledge of the assertive and dominant spiritual self, and lead finally to the manifestation of the kingdom of souls on earth. And what of the instinct to inquire? Transmuted into divine investigation and transformed by the application of the light of the soul in the realm of inquiry, we shall have humanity carried forward into the hall of wisdom, and thus man will leave behind the experiences of the hall of knowledge. Our great educational centers will become schools for the development of intuitive perception and of spiritual awareness. The following table should be carefully studied by the student. This table consists of three columns, the first column entitled Instinct, the second column Correspondence, third column Mode. 1. self-preservation, immortality, spiritualistic research. 2. Sex, spiritual union, religion, at-one-ment, mysticism. 3. Herd, group consciousness, brotherhood. 4. Self-assertion, assertion of the self, psychology. 5. Inquiry, intuition, education. Thus the fears which beset humanity, having their roots in instincts, seem nevertheless to be divine characteristics misapplied and misused. When, however, they are rightly understood and used and transmuted by the knowing soul, they produce awareness and are the source of growth, and that which conveys to the dormant soul, in time and space, the needed impulse, impetus, and urge to progress which have carried man forward from the caveman stage and the prehistoric cycle through the long period of history, and can be trusted today to carry him forward with increasing rapidity as he now arrives at intellectual comprehension and can apply himself to the problem of progress in full awareness. Students need to realize more deeply that the whole process is a divine one, and that evil, so-called, is but an illusion and an inherent part of duality, giving place in time and out of time to a divine unity. Evil is due to wrong perception and erroneous interpretation of that which is perceived. The achievement of true vision plus right understanding brings about freedom from the instinctual reactions and evokes that inner detachment which enables a man to walk at liberty in the kingdom of God. But what of the two fears with which the aspirant has peculiar concern? What of the fear of public opinion and fear of failure? These are two potent factors in the life of service and hinder many. Those who are beginning to work in cooperation with a plan and are learning the significance of service are prone to fear that what they do will be criticized and misjudged, or fall a victim to the reverse idea, that what they do will not be sufficiently liked, appreciated, and understood. They demand liking and praise. They gauge success by numbers and by response. They dislike to have their motives impugned and misjudged, and rush violently into explanation. They are unhappy if their methods, the personnel of their group, and the way in which their service is rendered comes under the tongue of criticism. The false objectives of numbers, of power, or of a formulated doctrine control them. Unless what they do measures up to the standards or conforms to the technique of the group of minds which surrounds them or appeals the most to them, they are unhappy and consequently frequently change their plans, alter their viewpoint, and lower their standard until it conforms to their immediate mass psychology or their chosen counselors. The true disciple sees the vision. He then seeks to keep so closely in touch with his soul that he can stand with steadiness whilst he endeavors to make that vision a reality. He aims to achieve what, from the standpoint of the world, seems to be impossible. Knowing that the vision is not materialized through expedience and undue adaptation of the suggested ideas of worldly or intellectual counselors. Public opinion and the advice of those who are Piscean in their tendencies and not Aquarian are carefully considered, but not unduly so, and when advice is found to be separative and tends to eliminate harmony and produces a lack of brotherly love and understanding, it is discarded at once. When there is evidenced a constantly critical attitude towards other workers in the field of world service, and where there is a capacity to see only selfishness and fault, and to impute wrong motives and to believe evil, then the true aspirant refuses to be swayed and goes serenely on his way. In the coming cycle, I emphatically tell you that the true work will be carried forward, the work of spiritually welding the world into a synthesis and the production of a recognized brotherhood of souls, only by those who refuse to be separative and whose words are watched so that no evil is spoken. These are the workers who see the divine in all and refuse to think evil and impute evil. They work with sealed lips. They deal not with their brothers' affairs, nor reveal that which concerns them. Their lives are colored by understanding and by love. Their minds are characterized by a trained spiritual perception and that spiritual awareness which employs a keen intellect as the corollary of a loving spirit. May I repeat in other words this theme, for its importance is vital and the effect of the work of these instruments on the world is immense. These men and women whose mission it is to inaugurate the new age have learned the secret of silence. They are animated ceaselessly by a spirit of inclusive love. Their tongues lead them not astray into the field of ordinary criticism, and they permit no condemnation of others. They are animated by the spirit of protection. To them will be committed the work of fostering the life of the new age. To those who have not yet reached this point in evolution, and whose vision is not so clear, nor their nature so disciplined, there remains the important work on a lower level of working with their kind. Their attributes and qualities bring to them those who resemble them. They do not work in such loneliness, and their work is more outwardly successful, though not always so. It must be remembered that all work in the sight of the Great Ones is of equal importance. For those souls who are at the stage where a home or office provides sufficient experience, that is for them the supreme effort. Their attempt to work is, on its own level, as great an achievement as to fulfill the destiny of a Christ or a Napoleon. Forget this not, and seek to see life truly and not with its distinctions, men made and dangerous. Vision of a more trained worker, and who is only just learning the ABC of public work, may, with all his failures and dense stupidities, be doing as well as an older disciple with his wider knowledge and experience. The New Age groups and training. To those of us who are working on the inner side, the workers in the world fall into three groups. One, those few and far between who are true Aquarians. These work under real difficulties, for their vision is beyond the grasp of the majority, and they meet often lack of understanding, frequent disappointment in their fellow workers, and much loneliness. Two, those who are straight Pisceans. These work with much greater facility and find a more rapid response from those around them. Their work is more doctrinal, less inclusive, and colored by the spirit of separation. They include the mass of world workers in all the various departments of human thought and welfare. 3. Those Pisceans who are enough developed to respond to the Aquarian message, but who, as yet, cannot trust themselves to employ the real Aquarian methods of work and message. For instance, they have in the political field a sense of internationalism, but they cannot apply it when it comes to the understanding of others. They think they have a universal consciousness, but when it comes to a test, they discriminate and eliminate. They constitute a much smaller group than the true Pisceans and are doing good work and filling a much needed place. The problem they present, however, to the Aquarian worker lies in the fact that though they respond to the ideal and regard themselves as of the new age, they are not truly so. They see a bit of the vision and have grasped the theory, but cannot express it in action. Thus we have these three groups doing much needed work and reaching through their united undertakings the mass of people and fulfilling thus their dharma. One group works necessarily under the glamour of public opinion. The intermediate group has a most difficult task to perform, for where there is no clear vision, the voice of their chosen environment and the voice of the inner group of world knowers are often in conflict, and they are pulled hither and thither as they respond first to one and then to the other. The group of those who respond more fully to the incoming Aquarian vibration register the voices of the leaders of the other two groups, but the voice of the guiding masters and the voice of the group of world masters serve to guide them unerringly forward. I have sought to explain the above modes and methods of work, for the times are hard and clarity of thought is needed if the work is to go forward as desired. Even such triple distinctions as exist between the groups are themselves of a separative tincture, and it is yet impossible to present any idea in its true and synthetic relation. It is again when the many thousands of separative groups can be grouped into three comprehensive ones, and the mind of the disciple be thus freed from the detailed analysis of the world situation among the workers with the plan. The second great test of the sensitive disciple is fear of failure. This is based on past experience, for all have failed, on a realization of the immediate need and opportunity, and on an acute appreciation of individual limitation and deficiency. It is the result, oft-times, of a response to the lowered spiritual and physical vitality of the race today. Never before has there been a time when fear of failure has more widely haunted the human family. Another cause of this reaction is to be found in the fact that man as a whole, and for the first time in the history of the race, senses the vision and has therefore a truer sense of relative values than ever before. Men know themselves to be divine, and this is becoming increasingly a universalization. Hence the present unrest and revolt from trammeling conditions. It is, however, a serious waste of time upon a failure or to fear failing. There is no such thing as failure. There can only be loss of time. That in itself is serious in these days of dire world need, but the disciple must inevitably someday make good and retrieve his past failures. I need not point out that we learn by failure, for that is a well-known truth and is known as such by all who are attempting to live as souls. Nor need the disciple sorrow over the failures, apparent or real, of his fellow disciples. The sense of time produces glamour and disappointment, whereas the work goes truly forward, and a lesson learnt by failure acts as a safeguard for the future. Thus it leads to rapid growth. An honest disciple may be momentarily glamoured, but in the long run, nothing can really deter him. What are a few brief years in a comparative cycle of eons? What is a second of time in a span of man's allotted 70 years? To the individual disciple, they appear most important. To the onlooking soul, they seem as nothing at all. For the world, perhaps, a temporary failure may connote delay in expected help, but that again is brief, and help will come from other sources, for the plan goes unerringly forward. May I, in all earnest, offer to you the paradoxical injunction to work with utter earnestness, and yet at the same time to refuse to work with such earnestness, and not to take yourself so earnestly? Those who stand on the inner side and study the work of the world aspirants today see an almost pitiful distress of individual deficiency, a sustained and strenuous effort on their part to make themselves what they ought to be, and yet at the same time a distressing lack of proportion and no sense of humor whatsoever. I urge upon you to cultivate both these qualities. Do not take yourself so seriously, and you will find that you will release yourself for freer and more potent work. Take the plan seriously and the call to serve, but waste not time in constant self-analysis. Therefore, the immediate goal for all aspiring disciples at this time can be seen to be as follows. 1. An achievement of clarity of thought as to their own personal and immediate problems, and primarily the problem as to their objective in service. This is to be done through meditation. 2. The development of sensitivity to the new impulses which are flooding the world at this time. This is to be brought about by loving all men more, and through love and understanding, contacting them with greatest facility. Love reveals. 3. The rendering of service with complete impersonality. This is done by eliminating personal ambition and love of power. 4. The refusal to pay attention to public opinion or to failure. This is done by the application of strict attention to the voice of the soul and by an endeavor to dwell ever in the secret place of the Most High. We have merged our first point as to the immediate goal and the steps to be taken to reach it with our second point as to conduct and the factors which must be eliminated. It only remains, therefore, to point out the penalties which will overtake the probationary disciple and the trained worker should he give way to the glamour and to the faults inherent in his nature, and permit them to hinder his work and come between him and the vision goal. It might be pointed out that there are three main points of danger in the life of service. I am not here dealing with the individual training of the disciple, but with his life of service and with the activities in which he is engaged as a worker. His temperament, equipment of characteristics, physical, emotional, and mental, do have a potent effect on his environment and on the people he seeks to help, and also his family background, his world training, and his speech. The first point of danger is his physical condition. On this I cannot enlarge beyond begging all disciples to act with wisdom, to give themselves sufficient sleep, right food, which must vary for each individual, and those surroundings, if possible, which will enable them to work with the greatest facility. The penalty for the infringing of these suggestions works out in lack of power in service and in the growing thraldom of the physical body. Where the physical body is in poor condition, the disciple has to add the liabilities incident upon the bringing in of force which he finds himself unable to handle. The second point of danger is to be found in the astral illusion in which all humanity lives, and its power to glamour even experienced workers. I have considered this at length in this treatise, which is, as you know, a treatise on the control of the astral body and a right understanding of its laws. Only mental control plus true spiritual perception will suffice to pierce this illusory astral miasma and reveal to the man that he is a spiritual entity in incarnation and in touch through his mind with the universal mind. The penalty which overtakes the disciple who persistently permits himself to be glamoured is obvious. His vision becomes fogged and misty, and he loses the sense of touch, as it is called in the old commentaries. He wanders down the lanes of life and misses that straight highway which will lead him to his goal. The third danger, and one that is very prevalent at this time, is that of mental pride and consequent inability to work in group formation. The penalty for this is often a temporary success and an enforced working with a group which has been devitalized of its best elements and which has in it only those people who feed the personality of the head of the group. Because of the emphasis upon his own ideas and his own methods of working, a disciple finds that his group lacks those factors and those people who would have rounded it out, who would have balanced his endeavor and given to his undertaking those qualities which he himself lacks. This is in itself a sufficient punishment and quickly brings the honest disciple to his senses. Let a disciple who is intelligent, honest, and basically true so err, and in time he will awaken to the fact that the group he has gathered around him are molded by him or molded by them. They are oft embodiments of himself and repeat him. The law works rapidly in the case of a disciple, and thus adjustments are speedily made. I would like to point out to the student that having with steadfastness gone forward, he will discover that the exoteric and esoteric linking of the outer schools and inner school or rank of knowers of truth is so close that not one earnest student goes totally unrecognized. In the press of the work, and in the burden and toil of the day's labors, it is an encouragement to know that there are those who watch, and that every loving deed, every aspiring thought, and every unselfish reaction is noted and known. Bear in mind, however, that it comes to the recognition of the helpers through the increased vibration of the aspirant, and not through a specific knowledge of the deed accomplished or the thought sent out. Those who teach are occupied with principles of truth, with the roots, and with the quality of the light to be seen. They are not aware of, nor have they the time to consider, specific deeds, words, and conditions. And the sooner students grasp this and put out of their minds any hope of contacting a phenomenal individual whom they call a master, with so much leisure, of such developed powers that he can occupy himself with their trivial affairs in time and space, the more rapidly will they progress. Where, however, there is steady growth, an application to occult principles so that definite changes are produced in the bodies used, and an increasing radiatory light, it is known and recorded, and the aspirant is rewarded by increased opportunity to serve his fellow men. They do not reward by commendation, by patting on the head, or by expressing their... They are occupied in making knowers and masters out of everyday men and women by, 1, teaching them to know themselves, 2, setting them free from authority by awakening interest and inquiry in their minds, and then indicating, not more than that, the direction in which the answer should be sought. 3, giving them those conditions which will force them to stand on their own feet and rely on their own souls and not on any human being, be he a beloved friend, teacher, or a master of the wisdom. I seek not to repeat myself. Most of the points that concern the work of the aspirant today I have considered earlier in this treatise. It remains now for all of you to study it with care. I close with an appeal to all who read these instructions to rally their forces, to renew their vows of dedication to the service of humanity, to subordinate their own ideas and wishes to the group good, to take their eyes off themselves and fix them anew upon the vision, to guard their tongues from idle speech and criticism, from gossip and innuendo, and to read and study so that the work may go intelligently forward. All students make up their minds in this day of emergency and of rapid unfolding opportunity to sacrifice all they have to the helping of humanity. Now is the need and the demand. The urgency of the hour is upon us, and I call upon all of you whom I am seeking to help to join the strenuous effort of the great ones. They are working day and night in an effort to relieve humanity and to offset those evils and disasters which are imminent in the present situation. I offer to you opportunity, and I tell you that you are needed, even the very least of you. I assure you that groups of students working in unison and with deep and unfaltering love for each other can achieve significant results. That each of you may so work, and that each of you may lose sight of self in the realization of world need, is the earnest prayer and deepest aspiration of your brother, the Tibetan.